Good morning. It is a Thursday, and that means it is time for Perspectives on WFSU-FM. Thanks so much for tuning in, for listening in. I'm Tom Flanagan, and before we get underway, a reminder, you're always invited to be a part of the proceedings via phone and email. 414-1234 is the telephone number locally. Long distance is 800-926-8809. We have an email, perspectives at WFSU.org, and if you like to tweet, you may Twitter at WFSU Perspective, and that is singular because we are such a singular program. You know, we have really become, if I can use the term, seething hotbed. Boy, is that an overused cliche, huh? Of literary talent in the Big Bend area, South Georgia, North Florida, this whole area, which has always had a propensity to generate great writers. There's the Southern tradition that goes way, way back, my gosh, to the days of the Civil War and probably predates that considerably. There is just something about the way the moon penetrates the magnolia blossoms and the dripping flora and fauna and all this other stuff that just brings about great writing. So I thought, in advance of an event that is coming up here on the 17th and 18th, which is a special conference and festival dedicated to writing here in Tallahassee, we bring on some writers to talk about what they do and perhaps give us some hints as to how any of us who have an idea of becoming a writer ourselves might proceed in that general direction, particularly in a world of writing that is changing so much. So let's welcome this morning Peggy Cassis, who is Vice President and Conference Co-Chair for the Tallahassee Writers Association. She specializes in paranormal, fantasy, and Southern Gothic work. She's just wrapped up one book. She's within a few pages of completing her second. And Peggy, thanks also for your help in putting together the panel today.
You're most welcome, Tom. Thank you for having us.
Right next door to you is Glenn Marsh Alam. She has authored 9 books, 8 of which are in the Luann Fogarty North Florida Mystery Series, the 7th book in that series winning the Florida Book Award in 2009. That is a huge accolade for sure. As so many folks have, Glenn was born and raised in Tallahassee. She relocated to another neck of the woods, namely Los Angeles, for a few years. She lost her way, and then she came back home, and we're happy to have her back in Tallahassee. Thanks for coming in, Glenn.
Thank you.
We also say hi to Anne Marie Bryan, CEO of Victorious by Design, LLC, editing, publishing, and ghostwriting, author of Unforgettable, My Love Has Come Along, which is an inspirational novel. And Anne Marie, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
We also have Sam Staley, written 5 books on public policy, and has penned 3 novels for middle graders and young adults. Middle grade action novel Renegade won 2nd place in the 2012 Seven Hills Literary Contest. And you may know Sam from his day job. He's managing director for the DeVoe L. Moore Center at Florida State. He also teaches in the departments of economics and urban planning. And in his abundant spare time, I hear he takes out the trash on Tuesdays. So
actually, it's Wednesdays.
Wednesdays. Yeah. Okay. I stand corrected. Thanks a lot. Yeah, we got to find out just how you do, you know, your time management thing. That sounds incredible.
Well, Tuesday would probably put it over the edge.
Over the edge.
Wednesday garbage works out.
Also, we wrap up things here with writer, naturalist, and activist Susan Cerulean, latest book, a nature memoir entitled Tracking Desire, A Journey After Swallow-Tailed Kites. And that sounds like a fascinating excursion in and of itself, Susan.
Thank you. Yeah, and actually since then I did an anthology called Unspoiled, and that's the last time I came and spoke with you here 3 years ago.
That's, oh my gosh.
When the oil spill came.
That is right. And my gosh, you've been an editor of many other works too, director of the Red Hills Writers Project, many other awards and recognition. So we're honored to have you here.
Thank you.
Let's get right into the writing thing. Everyone, I think, has the great American novel or something deep, deep down inside, but may have trouble bringing it out. And Peggy, how do you bring it out? Did you always know that you had this ability to take something out of your head and put it on paper?
Oh, yes. I've written forever, it seems like. I started with poetry, actually. And my 6th grade teacher encouraged me to go ahead and let my more crazy side out and not to worry about trying to please others, but to do the thing that was inside me wanting to grow. And I owe her to this day, and Lula Fern Klein. It's always good to have a mentor, someone that will work with you.
How about you, Glenn? How did you get into the writing biz?
Well, I was writing all my life, little stories and things, but and I'd always wanted to publish. But I was a great reader of mystery. I started reading, writing short stories, and to my surprise, people actually bought them and published them. So then I went into the novel publishing, and I just kept on writing them, and then they're all based right here. You'll recognize the swamps and the and the Wakulla Springs and the sinkholes and the whole thing. I don't call it that, but that's where it's located, and they're all mystery novels.
Want to talk to you some more about that then. Anne-Marie, your background in writing.
Never thought of being a writer. Never. Love reading. But I happened to get married, and then everybody wanted to know my story. So I thought, oh, let me just put it in a book. And that I did.
And that's how it all started.
Oh my! Right. Last year.
Last year. Okay. Sam, your story.
Actually, it's a somewhat meandering story because the nonfiction was pretty straightforward because working in the area of public policy analysis, what you're doing is communicating. You're communicating to people that don't have the same level of expertise as you might have, having gone through, in my case, graduate school and gotten all of that. So really the books in particular became a way of communicating ideas that were bigger than could be handled in smaller venues like op-eds. And so – and they just came as the issues became important, and then my employers decided that certain issues were more important than others, and so they just came through that. So it was very professional in that sense. The fiction really came about from my interest in just trying something new, getting outside the box. And frankly, my mother-in-law at the time, it was a middle school librarian, just lamenting the lack of good middle grade and junior high books. And I said, yeah, I can do that. Well, not so much. I mean, it took me a long time to work at it, but I found that I fell in love with writing fiction, and particularly for the middle grade and the young adult. I loved the idea of working with characters and building stories. It actually helped my nonfiction quite a bit because I understood character and I understood story. And so I'm more of a character-driven author because I just like people and I like my stories to revolve around relationships.
Is it tough getting back into the head of a 12 or 13 or 14-year-old?
Actually, since these books were written when my kids were getting into that age, it was really important for me to get in the head of a 12 or 13-year-old. So it is, and I think that's one of the challenges that I enjoy about it because it forces me as an adult to begin to think about the human experience in a much more layered and complicated way and understand how current events shape the way our children are, the kinds of things that they face, and I can reflect on it when I was growing up. So for me, it's sort of – the fiction has made me a better parent, better adult, better policy analyst. On every level of the human experience, I'm better simply because it's forced me to really reach out and really spread my mind and challenge my thinking about all sorts of things.
Susan Sterling, in your case, what came first, the naturalist or the writer, or did they both kind of emerge at the same time?
I think it was a slow, long process. And I was just thinking as I listened to each of the panel this morning how often writers, and that would include myself, tend to be more introverted and need time. And they're speaking, if not for marginalized people or characters or even themselves, they can put themselves there. And for me, I'm interested in speaking for the landscape and for – I'd like to put myself in the head of a bird. I would just really like to be able to be there. So I think I kind of – when I moved to Florida in the 70s, I started reading some of our writers like Zora Neale Hurston, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, Archie Carr, Patrick Smith, fiction and nonfiction both. And then I started to write myself into where I live – where we live here in the panhandle, and what is at stake here in our place.
That is something I wanted to talk to you too about, Peggy, since mm-hmm. of this great Southern tradition, which I
yes.
don't think this is a myth. There seems to be some reality to this, that this particular piece of geography that we live in is the jump starter for all kinds of imagery
right.
and fantastic wordplay just because it exists. Is that what you said?
It's a love affair with the land. There's no place like the Big Bend area. I didn't grow up here, but I was fortunate to move here in 1975. And it's home. It's home. The cypress knees, the trees that scrub the sky, the water that's so black that it's tinted from eons and eons of roots growing in there. That's what I write about. That's where my characters take place now. True, I pick up a rock and I don't see dirt under it. I see a sprite or a fairy or some evil worm coming from another dimension. But it's still here and it's still around the Tallahassee area. It's hard to leave home. It's a good place.
Yeah, and Glenn, as you said, you know, your work is very, very much based on this particular bit of geography, too.
Yes, I grew up here, and when I pick up that rock, I see a water moccasin in it. I use the terrain and what's in this terrain as part of the mystery. It becomes a character in the books, really, because it's very dangerous if you don't know the area. You can be killed by nature as well as by some criminal.
Yeah, that area called Tate's Hell, that is not just
yes.
a euphemism. That is reality down there for anyone
That's
who's
right.
got
That's
stuck
right.
there and can't find their way back out again.
Right. That's true.
Okay. Sorry. Is your work also somewhat connected to the area too, Anne-Marie?
Definitely connected because we're here, you know, in Tallahassee. Love Tallahassee. Love the people. Love the hospitality. In fact, I thought when I left school, I graduated from FAM, I would have left here. But every time I go away from Tallahassee and I come back, I feel like I want to kiss the earth. It's so serene here. You know, just the whole environment and the people are so friendly. You know, everybody saying hello, hi, how you doing? Love it. Love it a lot.
Yeah, it's very much like a retrograde. It's a return to something that so many other parts of this country seem to have lost. Mm-hmm. Some of the great urban centers, you move down to a place like, and nothing gets you, Stephen Rodriguez, who's back there working the phones and the emails and the tweets today, but he hails from a very urbanized area called South Florida. Totally different kind of environment and upbringing. Still a lot of nature, but it's of a different sort. And that seems to generate a different kind of literature out of that area than what we have up here in North Florida. Lots more to come, and we'd love to hear from you, too. 414-1234, 800-926-8809, and perspectives at WFSU.org is the email. Twitter, at WFSU Perspective. We'll be right back. Have you ever wanted to be a writer? It seems like in many ways it can be a glamorous and a wonderful way to live your life, to be able to express your innermost thoughts or to create entire new worlds in your head and then communicate it to other people via the written and, in many cases, spoken word, too. We have a great writers panel here on Perspectives today who would be delighted to talk with you if you have any idea about becoming a writer or tapping into what makes for a good writer. And that's maybe our next question. To your way of thinking as a writer, Susan Cerulean, what makes for a good one? Well, I mean, you read a particular tract and you think, wow, that's wonderful. That's great.
Well, you know who flashed into my mind was Connie Mae Fowler. She can write stories that come from the ether, but they're really rooted in right here. And I think that's what makes a good writer. Someone who can make you stay up past when you think you should. Someone who has sometimes maybe born with a little bit of genius. But I also think that anyone can be a writer because we are humans. We are born to tell stories. And it's a matter of commitment. And it's also a matter of, for me recently, finding someone, and I think this is what the writers group is all about, that you can exchange your work with, that you can feel comfortable with. And I have had the thrill of a partnership with a poet, Mary Jane Ryles, during this last year. And every week we meet and we've exchanged chapters, and that has pushed us both along in our work more than I would have ever thought possible. So there's an inside dimension and an outside.
Okay. Sam?
Yeah, it's interesting because especially since I've been back in Tallahassee, I've been reading a lot of material from a lot of people from different genres, in part because of my work with the Tallahassee Writers Association, and we're also now running the TWA blog for the Democrat. And so I'm reviewing – but I've also just developed a passion for just reading our local authors because they just have all these really interesting stories. But I think, of course, I teach at university, so I'm getting papers all the time of varying quality. I think it's true that everyone has a story. And I think what makes a good writer, there are two things. And I think it's building on, I think, what Susan. I think there has to be some passion for whatever you're writing. It could be landscape, it could be people, but there has to be some element of the passion of what the story you want to tell, and that has to make it onto the page at some point. But then the other part is getting the support to understand there's also a craft that's part of it. It's not just about putting words on a paper. It's putting words on a paper that are able to communicate that passion to a reader, and that requires work. It actually requires – some people are very talented, but even the most talented people still have to work at their writing. And so finding support groups like TWA, or there's also the Authors Network, which is another group in Tallahassee, really becomes important because, as I've learned through my fiction in particular, public policy was more gradual. I didn't even really notice what was happening, but my fiction was more deliberate. There's a big difference between my first novel, which, by the way, my first novel is still in a drawer in my bedroom because it's so bad I couldn't get it out. But then my most recent one, which is Renegade, which won the award, the craftsmanship is just higher because I've been around people that have given me support, given me direction, and I've been willing to be coached by other people. So you need both of those.
And you can look back, too, at the first one and think, whoa, I've
absolutely
come a long way.
I know why the publisher didn't pick it up.
Yeah.
I'll just put it that.
Henry Bryan, what excites you?
Oh, dancing. Dancing excites me, but writing is something I am growing into. It's like a new thing for me. I believe a good writer is somebody who understands the readers in that genre and communicates a story so that the readers feel that they're a part of that story. And not only communicate, but the readers should learn something. It should enhance their life in some way or bring some kind of emotion out of that reader.
So it has to involve them directly then and really suck them into that narrative.
Like Susan said, you want to stay past the time you know you should be up. It holds you. That book holds you.
And when you're reading, what do you look upon as, this is the ultimate. This is what I really involves me, that pulls me in.
Well, he said, that passion has got to be there. And you can see it in a writer, whether they may have passion for their characters and then they've gotten into the psychology of the character and so on. You can see that. When someone is simply writing a genre because they think that genre will sell, you can tell it in a minute. It's not good, it's dull, and it comes out that way. It has to come from inside of you. But also, when you have a passion for writing and for your characters, there's a lot of research that goes on, and I like to do hands-on research where I'm talking to people, I'm visiting sites. I've been to the oyster shucking business in Apalachicola just to see what was going on there, and how crime could enter into that picture. So you have to have that kind of passion and want to put it on paper and then sit down and actually finish the book.
Okay, so you've done the on-site research then to,
yes,
this is where my characters are going to live, and you really want to make sure that there's a great deal of veracity there. That feels right. That could happen.
Right, and you come up with things that you never knew were there. Even though you might have grown up here, there are things that come out in this research that are very surprising, which you can put in your books too.
Now, Peggy Cassis, mm-hmm. you've got another problem, though. You're trying to create, in many instances, whole new worlds that don't really exist. So
correct.
How do you do that?
Well, you have to kind of weave it in with the here and the now, with the people that you know. And you have a contract with your reader that you're asking them to suspend the everyday knowledge and to accept yours. And in my world, I have took an old fable from Aesop where he speaks of Zeus wanting to be worshipped and the gods just weren't worshipping him like he thought he should be done. And therefore, he asked Prometheus to make him some beings that would worship him. And Prometheus made people and animals and critters. And Zeus said, okay, I like the two-legged ones because they're going around and they're worshiping me really good. But these other things with the fur and the feathers and the fins and stuff, they just kind of doing whatever they want to do. You just kill them off and make me some more people. Well, Prometheus was in love with the critters that he made, and he didn't want to kill them. And so, therefore, instead of doing that, he just kind of took the people characteristics and added it to the critters. And that's why I've come up with a new group of people called the Prometheans, and they're not quite human. They can change to whatever critter they were or human back and forth at their will. And so if you kind of weave things in, I think it makes it a little more believable, but you have to have a contract with your reader that they're willing to go along with you as long as you can make it fit.
Oh, okay. Well, you pulled that then from, you know, an ancient
right.
Greek tale. Does this mean that there's nothing new in literature? We're all taking little bits and pieces of stuff that was done before, and we're kind of maybe repackaging it or reinterpreting it to come up with something new, but it's really not. It's all been done before. I'll just throw that out.
Well, yeah. I think so. I've always heard that all the plots have been done. It's just the way you do them. And I think so.
I think there's another dimension to it. It's because they're right. There are, if you look at basic plots, and screenwriters run into this all the time, they're basically seven. I think, and I can't remember what all my son knows because he does the screenwriting. What makes it different, and this is where the passion really becomes important, mm-hmm. is because the passion of the writer sees an insight into the way that plot works that is different because of the nature of the character they've developed. So you actually get something very fresh out of the same old – so it's not the same old plot. There's a twist to that the writer has added to that, and that's what makes a successful story. It's not that – we've all heard Romeo and Juliet. Everyone's life, we run into a Romeo and Juliet story, but it's different. And so what you're doing as a writer, you're bringing that difference in, and that usually is triggered by that passion. You saw that insight. You said, that is what's different. I haven't seen that before, and it's really cool, and I'm going to try and put that in a story. And then you wrap it in. So it ends up, in my view, while if you strip it down academically, they're all the same plot, the reality is they're all different.
Right.
Because all humans have a skeleton, but all humans are different. And that's what makes it cool and different and interesting.
I think what you're talking about is voice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because right. even though there may in fiction only be a certain limited number of plots, each one of us is completely unique on this planet. We have different dreams, we have different life experiences, different ancestors, and our body is our instrument. As a writer or whatever we are. So our voices are different, and that's what makes the writing keep coming fresh, I think.
Yeah, what was it, that old saw on TV from the 60s? I think there are 8 million stories in the Naked City, and this is one of them. And everyone has a story, and everyone has the ability to reinterpret someone else's story mm-hmm. in a new and different way and put that unique spin on it then.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did anyone bring a little sample of some of your stuff here? We can have like a bit of a round table. And I saw Glenn Marsh Alam just whip open her book right here, and she is ready to go. What's yours, Glenn?
This is from my latest book, Tidewater Talisman. I get a germ of an idea, and that's how I build my stories. And this is Katrina refugees who came to Florida temporarily right after the storm, and a lot of them stayed. And that's where it takes place, on the coast of Florida with a bunch of refugees from the – but anyway, there are a couple of divers. I have a lot of diving in my books. And there are a couple of divers, and they have been asked to go down to look for a weapon that was used to kill someone, but they find something else. Now, I use diving as part of the suspense. I'm not writing a diving technical book, okay? And these are the two people who are going down. The tidal waters were against us as we tried to rummage through the grass. The banks near the bridge were lined with river rock and some broken concrete. Single blades of the deep green eelgrass grew from narrow cracks. The manatees stayed away from the rock siding, but I was betting it wasn't because they knew it might scratch their skin. They stuck to the deeper channels in the middle of the river lane. At least I thought they did. Vernon and I both caught sight of something large snagged on a jutting piece of concrete. I expected to see a dead manatee, its heavy body bloated with gases and decomposing underwater. We moved closer, both of us stopping our swim abruptly and staring at the large piece of gray material clinging to the broken edge. Torn in many places, it was still recognizable as an overcoat of some kind, perhaps a raincoat made of canvas. I moved closer and grabbed the piece that was waving in the currents while Vernon took the other side. He pulled on an edge of hem material. As we pulled back the coat, a belt buckle appeared, then dropped into the flowing water. I made an attempt to grab it, causing me to jerk my end of the cloth. I realized then it was a sleeve, or what was left of one. And it had an arm inside it, or what was left of one.
Mm. Oh, my gosh. Glenn Marsh Allen from the Tidewater Talisman. That's, the visuals there are just terrific.
Yeah, thank you.
That's great. Sam Seely, what you got there?
Yeah, I'm just going to read the first couple paragraphs from Renegade, which is my – it's a the Renegade as well as the – this is the second book in the Path of the Warrior series, which is about bullying in schools, and they're set – and so the protagonists are seventh graders. And so these books are both dealing with issues of violence in schools and also how our kids deal with it, and they have strong self-defense themes. So this is really sort of setting up the – this in this particular school, it's an urban school environment, and this is really focused on girls and how that plays out. And this is the book that got second place in the Seven Hills Literary Contest.
Okay.
So I'll just start a few paragraphs and see where we go. And I have to take my glasses off because I'm old and getting older every day. But anyway. A sharp pain suddenly clawed into the back of Maria's hand as her school book spewed from her arms and scattered across the floor. She drew in a deep breath to calm herself, realizing the instant anger she felt rising from somewhere inside her chest would just make everything worse. "What are you doing in my way, Brulah?" Maria didn't look toward the voice. That would give her no way out. But she could tell by the ever-so-slight trembling in the girl's tone that this was the challenge, which was strange. No one usually challenged her so early in the school day. No more than 15 minutes had passed since she had walked in the front door, retrieved her books from her locker, and walked up to the second floor for her first class. The wannabes trying to get into the school gangs usually waited until around lunchtime, when their fights would be covered up by the noise of lunch or the chaos of students changing classes midday. Whoever this girl was, she wanted to get it over with, fast. A slight smile turned up at the corners of Maria's mouth. Even though she knew the challenge would end up poorly for both of them, the new girl would be hurt, probably badly, and Maria would be suspended from school, she couldn't help but admire the girl's spunk, just a little. Maria closed her eyes, wishing this were just a dream, resisting the urge to look at the girl.
You just yanked me back into middle school there. And
I know.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to find a way back out. That's not the happiest of times. And that's Sam Staley from Renegade. What you got, Susan Cerulean?
I'll take you to the beach.
Okay. That sounds like a nice respite from middle school.
This is a little snippet from my newest book, which is called Coming to Pass, Memoirs of the St. Island Coast. It's about our coast and what's happening to it and what it still has. And this was what I saw on the beach one day. Caitlin had the look of a girl who spent a lot of hours alone with her outdoorsman dad. Any wind could tangle her hair, unbound by a mother's careful braids or pigtails. She was a child used to entertaining herself while her father baited his hooks and cast them into the current. She was long-legged and knob-kneed and always on the move, singing and talking to herself and her father and to the fish in her father's bucket. She was curious and in conversation with all of the living expressions of the past. And she was alert to the wild birds. I saw that about her right away. The eagle that caught my eye, she also acknowledged with a swivel of her head, following its flight over to the island. When a second great blue heron began its dance down near the boat ramp, Caitlin's own limbs took note and followed, copying the angular lift of the bird's knee and wing. Her arms opened like the heron's two lacy parasols, unscripted, loose-jointed, girl-joyous. The wind took her hair just as it lifted the bird's shimmering plumes. I deeply admired her physical communion with all that was. She was the closest thing to crossing over to being bird that I've ever seen.
And that is Susan Cerulean from Coming to Pass. Very nice. Do you have one, Anne-Marie?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Tell us about this one.
My book is called Unforgettable, My Love Has Come Along. My sister wanted to introduce me to now my husband, but I wasn't interested because he was all the way on the island, Jamaica, and I was here. And he finally called one day, and, you know, I was really interested. It was just a call. And then he called again, and, you know, he piqued my interest, but I wanted to know what he looked like. So here we go.
Before you begin here, I don't want to cut you off, and I hear now our producer, Taylor's telling us here, just in a moment, we're going to take a short time out. So you have set it up for us. We have the scene all set, and we'll be able then to come back and hear your take on that particular scenario. A writer's roundtable here on Perspectives Today. Your input, too, at 414-1234, if you're so inclined, 800-926-8809. We'll be back in a moment and hear Anne-Marie Bryan's piece of art in just a moment. Writers Roundtable here on Perspectives Today. We were just having a setup for Anne-Marie Bryan talking, giving us a little foretaste here of one of her bits that she is just about ready to read for. So you had set the scene, the table is ready to go, and it's all yours.
While Orain's words were capturing my attention, I had no idea what he looked like. Was I living on the edge? No, definitely not. I was waiting, sometimes impatiently and even a little apprehensively. Orain had promised to email me pictures which seemed to be taken forever. In the meantime, I tried not to weave a web of thoughts and paint an ideal picture of him. "Where are the photos?" I asked Orain, due none of our nightly conversation. "I have not forgotten," he responded. "I'll be taking the new shots soon." "What happened to the old shots?" "Trust me, you would prefer the new shots." I sighed, flopping backwards on my bed. "Okay, Orain, send them before I turn 100 years old." He chuckled softly. "You are rough." "A diamond in the rough," I giggled. "Be patient." Maiden and Harriet's description of Orain did not put me at ease. "He looks nice," they reported. "What exactly does that mean? Plain and simple? I would absolutely love to see the man behind the voice." The suspense was too much. Finally, weeks of anticipation inch closer to fulfillment. During a lunch hour conversation, Orain informed me that he had emailed the pictures. I was ecstatic. I wanted to climb on a soapbox and announce it to the world. My heart soared with excitement until it suddenly hit me. Am I ready to see this man?
Talk about a setup. My Lord. Peggy Cassis, what you got?
Well, I have a little bit of good old Nellie. She's become a Promethean after she was rescued. She'd been captured and kidnapped and thrown off the side of a mountain, left for dead when she was found and changed to become one of them. I hold out my hand, watch as my fingers glow a soft blue, and 3-inch claws ease out. Becoming a Promethean healed me from the damage inflicted during captivity and changed me right down to my DNA. I withdraw my claws and allow my hand to change back to human. The reason for the nightmares is clear. The men have found me. A picture of the Italian Alps is featured on the front of a postcard that I recently received. No need for me to turn it over. I know by heart the words on the back. I strip out of my damp clothes and let blue light wash over me and change fully. As myself, I'm straight up 6 feet tall. In my other form, I rock out over 8 feet, not including the flyers. I throw back my muzzle, extend leathery wings, and trill until the metal roof vibrates. I swear on Prometheus' fire, they will be the ones to suffer this time. Fist clenched, I draw another deep breath as my tail smacks the wall behind me. I yodel a battle trill that rattles the cups and utensils in the kitchen. You go ahead and mess with me, but I'm here to tell you, I'm the strongest, meanest, toughest gargoyle you'll ever know, and you're dead.
Peggy Cassis there. And we go to the phones now on Perspectives as we continue our writer's roundtable. By the way, 414-1234-800-926-8809. Thanks for hanging on. Neil, welcome to Perspectives.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, it's going. Thanks.
I just had a question. I was going to ask the male author, but I guess I'll open up to everyone on the roundtable. How do you approach writing from the opposite sex? As in, if you're a male author, how do you approach writing a female character and vice versa?
Oh, great. Great question. We'll start with you then, Sam Staley, since you were kind of in the head of the mean girl there by the locker in middle school.
Yeah, it's interesting because even as a male, honestly, I find in my novels my female characters the most interesting. And so I don't know if it's because I'm male and I just think I understand the male view, and so I try to layer my characters in one way or the other. But it's surprisingly easy. I think the key is to really try to understand the character, try to understand the kinds of things that they are facing as an individual. Interestingly enough, in another book, The Pirate of Panther Bay, which has as the lead character is a female pirate captain who's an escaped slave. And I was talking to one of my friends who is again, this is Haiti in the 18th century. There's another challenge, not just she's female, but she's also a black character. So in a historical character, and I was talking to one of my friends who's African-American, who's actually a director in New York where he deals with – and he's writing ethnic plays and producing them. And we were talking about race and we're talking about how do you sort of get into that character. And the reality is each of my characters is human first. And so once they're human first, it actually makes it very easy for me as an author. I don't get hung up on whether they're female. That being female then becomes part of the context and the world in which she operates. And so it gives it a universal nature to the character that I think it makes it easier as an author. That could also be in denial. I mean, maybe there's other stuff going on too. But it's and the more authors I've talked to, a number of authors find it easier writing characters of the opposite sex. And I'm not completely sure what the psychology behind it is. Maybe we need to go into therapy. I don't know. that might help. But I find the context of those characters really intriguing. To me, that's one of the things as a writer that draws me into it. It draws me into the story. So I find it surprisingly easy and not nearly as much of a challenge as I thought it would be.
Okay, ladies, shape-shifting here, whether you're a gargoyle like Peggy has or trying to get inside the mind of an Anhinga like Susan does. Is that a bigger challenge, though, to find a character who may be diametrically opposed to you and trying to think, how would they approach this? How would they react? What would they think? Is that a big challenge, or you just?
Well, you got to do your research.
Exactly,
that can be interesting. I don't write from the male point of view, but I have a lot of males in there because obviously most traditional sheriff's departments have been male, and I have a woman and her reaction in that environment who has to react to these men. And I look around me. I see what happens in real life. I see what they do. And you can find just about everything in real life, and they will react in various ways. There are the stereotypical ways, but you don't want to dwell on those. You want to find out what is unique about the way they are treating this woman.
Okay, well, Anne is on the line, and I think she is right in the same kind of context that we're talking about here and can push us a little further. Hey, Anne, welcome.
Hi.
Hi. Yes, go ahead.
First, a shout out, hello to all my TWA friends. This is Anne Petty.
Well, hey, Anne. Anne has a wonderful book, The Cornerstone Ruin. It is just a marvelous, well-written book, Anne. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I'm not going to be able to, I'm not well enough to go to the conference this year, but I hope for good luck for all of you.
My question
has to do with research. Obviously, what I write is often not real time, or not even real world, but a lot of research goes into what I do, even though it may not be real, you know, real world stuff. So my question is, how important do you rate research, and how do you go about it?
Boy, that's a good one. Who wants to start off on that?
I'm happy to start out on that.
Okay, Peggy, go ahead.
Research is number one, Anne. You have to know the world around you before you can construct another world. The basic precepts of interchange, the way people relate to each other, relate to the area around them, the land, all of that's important. And if whatever you're doing, you have to have it make sense, and which you do very well. But research, whether you do fantasy or real life, it's the number one thing.
Okay, so it can't just come unbidden from the brain where it just kind of comes out and there you have it done. You've actually got to do – in our craft, it would be called journalistic legwork, mm-hmm. where you have to talk to people. Mm-hmm. And like you said, Glenn, where you're actually going to a location where the story's going to take place and see if you can put it into it. And I imagine – let's see, Susan, you're out in the woods and the fields and the – everything?
Yeah, it takes to do the kind of writing I do is you have to be out there a lot, and that's the joy of it. But we also have great resources here in terms of scientists. I spend a lot of time interviewing mm-hmm. people here at the university, and using librarians to access online databases has totally changed what's available to us. Mm-hmm. I think, though, for at least for my kind of writing, for getting into the minds of an Anhinga, which I never have done yet, I think there's a way that I'm looking to drop all my Western influences because those don't inform the animal kingdom. And so stay tuned. I'll see how I do.
Okay, that sounds interesting. See if we can get in one more call, and then we want to talk about the conference here. Hey, Paula.
Hello. This is Paula Anderson. I'm an adjunct at TCC in English and Communications and Humanities. Most of these people, if not all, because I came in late to your presentation, have come to my classes on their own time. Many times, for some reason, it's been raining every time they've come. But they've come to my night classes, and they've spread their talents and their abilities across a wide spectrum of students who are taking English classes at TCC. And they have inspired many young people to come to the TWA, and I just thought maybe they deserve to have that part of their contribution to the community be acknowledged on the air.
Paula, you are most kind, and thanks for bringing to the attention of all the listeners the fact that these folks are out there and about and providing themselves as a resource to up-and-coming young writers, which I believe, what a great segue, is the purpose or one of the purposes of the Tallahassee Writers Conference and Book Festival upcoming May 17th through the 18th at the Four Point Sheraton downtown. And Peggy Cassis, you're kind of in the maelstrom here of trying to get all that pulled together in time. So what's that all about?
Well, this is going to be one of the most wonderful conferences, and we've kept it down to Friday evening and all day Saturday. And it's Discovering Florida Authors in honor of our 500th anniversary of our state's discovery. It's going to be held at the Four Points Sheraton downtown, right there on Tennessee Street. And we have speakers from a variety of topics, from flash fiction to various aspects of the writing craft. Diane is going to be there. Diane Roberts is going to be there for our Friday evening keynote speaker, and really looking forward to that. She has a wonderful sense of humor, wrote Dream State, and she's going to be talking about how the Land of Flowers turned into the Magic Kingdom and what our writers said about it. So I'm looking forward to that. We have workshop presenters coming Saturday, and you have options to see to speak with them, and you also are going to be able to learn from them. Jamie Morris is going to be there early at 7 for those who just can't wait to get started. And then we have a breakfast that is included in it. Mark Ari, The Wink of Immediacy, Flash Fiction Workshop. Vic DeGenti, How to Write Killer Fiction. Jamie Morris with The Plot Clock. Diane Roberts will also be teaching besides speaking. So we are looking forward to that. Janine Capo-Cruzet, Dying is Easy, Comedy is Hard, Using Humor in Fiction. And then Jamie Morris and Julie Compton, Backstory, A Fine Balance. And we hope that you will balance your writing career and writing desires out by coming to our conference.
And how does one find out more about it and registration and all that sort of thing?
www.twaonline.org. That is the place to go, and you can register there. If you are a TWA member, it is $100. If you are not a TWA member, it is $135, but that also gives you membership to the Tallahassee Writers Association.
Well, that sounds like a terrific opportunity not only to have some interaction with the folks that you mentioned, Diane Roberts, et cetera, but also to plumb the depths of other writers who are going to be there. I imagine, right. What, a couple hundred you're expecting? Or?
Oh, yes. Well, we're expecting right around 100.
Okay.
And hope we have plenty of room for whoever wants to come. We have a book festival Friday night that is free and open to the public with heavy hors d'oeuvres and a cash bar. And that is for anyone who would like to come, and I hope you take advantage of it and come out there.
Again, that's going to be May 17th and 18th at the Four Point Sheraton downtown Tallahassee, the Round Hotel.
Absolutely.
That used to be next to Mays Monroe, which is no longer there anymore. It's such a shame. But anyway, they're still out on Capitol Circle. In the just moments that we have remaining here, folks, would you do it again as a writer if you had it all to do over again, Susan Cerulean, would you?
Yes, I absolutely would. I wouldn't do it to become rich. But yes, just for the joy of being able to do art, yes.
Okay, and same thing with you, Sam?
Oh, yeah. It's certainly not something you do to get wealthy. But and one of the things I think we talk about with Paula Anderson's class, which, by the way, they're a wonderful class. She's a great teacher at TCC. Another example of the depth we have in the Tallahassee area, it's not just one university. It's really many universities, many teachers, reaches into the high schools and the middle schools as well, passionate teachers. Yeah, but the writing is just a – there's no question it enhances my humanity by just being involved in doing – in the process. So it is a labor of love, but it's also just a way to – it's just a way to just become more engaged with the community and more engaged with people and understand myself even more.
And Anne-Marie Bryan, since you have recently gotten into writing here, you're coming in at a time when there are vast amounts of changes. We could devote a whole program to that, certainly. But the fact that the writing that you will do maybe 5-10 years from now might be promulgated in a much different fashion than what you're doing right now, but you're still eager and ready to ride with
it. Oh, absolutely. It's a newfound joy for me, actually. I'm actually in the middle of my second book. I love to impart, and I find this is a way that I can share my stories with others. My aim is to build lives, to really help to develop people, be it writing or in other areas of their life. And I find this is a new outlet for me, a new avenue where I can do that.
Okay.
Absolutely love it.
Let's see if we could ask you, Glenn Marsh Alam. You were saying you were traditional or going through traditional roots here to promulgate your work now, but
yes.
Now that's changing too, isn't it?
Oh, it's changing drastically. My first book came out in 2000, and I had to send in a hard copy and so on to a publisher in New York, and it's great because I don't have to do anything but write the book. And they put the book in the bookstores. They do all of that stuff. Of course, I have to do promotion after that. But it's changing so much now. And my publisher put all of my books on Kindle when it first came out, and they're selling quite well on Kindle, better than in bookstores, by the way. But it's changing drastically. And the big New York publishers are, I think, worried, and they're sort of hustling to find other ways to join the e-books and the and the more digital publishing. William Morrow announced today they're starting a new mystery line that's all digital publishing. So, yes, it's changing, and I would say 10 years from now it will be totally different. I don't know what it will be, but
yeah, we saw what happened here locally. Well, nationally with Borders, that chain going away, you know, Barnes and Noble's trying to reposition itself, and you have the small independently owned bookstores. They're struggling and all, but without writers, we wouldn't have anything along that line to talk about. And Peggy Cassis, again, thank you so much for helping us put this together today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Glenn Marsh, Alam, Sam Staley, and of course Anne Marie, Brian, and Susan Cirilli. And delight to have you on Perspectives today. And we'll see you at the conference in a couple weekends.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Perspectives produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. Technical assistance by Taylor Cox. And we had Stephen Rodriguez doing his swan song back in there with the phones and the emails and the tweets. And I'm Tom Flanagan. We're going to go medical again next week right here on Perspectives. Hope you can join us then. Take care.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.